Let me do some quick reminder what we are trying to do. So we consider type 2B on R3,1 times the Calabi-Yau. This Calabi-Yau is non-compact, and furthermore is a cone over a Sasaki-Einstein manifold. And it's dual to, we put the three brains. On R3,1, and this background is dual to ADS5 times X, where X is this Sasaki-Einstein manifold. And we want to study examples, and I'm going to present a general procedure of how to derive the gauge theory on the D3 brain as dual to the Sasaki-Einstein manifold. And as we will see, today I'm not going to write metrics. I'm not going to use metrics. I'm going to use many algebraic properties which describe features of those metrics. And in next week, we will hear more about those particular metrics. Jerome will give a talk. I believe it will be related. I didn't ask you, so no, probably not. Okay. So Sergio Benvenuti will give a talk about some of those metrics, and Chris Herzog will give a lecture about how to derive the gauge theory using exceptional collections. But what I'm going to do today is to describe how to get the gauge theory using tilings. And then we will see how we can get the properties of the, how can we relate to the metric or to the Sasaki-Einstein manifold using dimers. And last time, the end of the discussion was with the following tiling. It was a rectangular tiling, periodic tiling on the two-dimensional plane. And let's be even, let's do the same tiling as last time. Do I have color chalks? This will be useful. I don't. And we said that we are able to read the gauge theory from this tiling using the following rules. So faces are gauge groups. So in these examples, we have two gauge groups. Edges are bifundamental fields. And nodes are superpotential terms. And so let's construct the gauge theory which we have from this style. Another rule which is not specified here is that there are oriented arrows which alternate as we go around the face. So if this is going out, this will go in, this will go out, and this will go in. Okay, and around this face, this comes in, this goes out, in, and out, and so on. And we find that there are two types of nodes. This node, arrows go counterclockwise, and a node which is neighbor to it, to this one, the arrows go clockwise. Okay? So we will call clockwise arrows. Sometimes we will call them white, and counterclockwise will be black. This is just a notation. And we will assign a plus sign in the superpotential to those arrows and minus sign to those arrows. Okay? Now, in our example, there are two faces. Each face has two outgoing arrows. And so altogether, we have four different fields. Okay? We can denote them using the usual notation of Weavers. If this is the first group and this is the second group, we see that face number one has two arrows going out to two, and face number two has two arrows going out to one. So this is the familiar quiver of the conifold. We can also write the superpotential according to this rule. Let's give names to those fields. Let's say that this guy is A1, this guy is A2, and this guy is B1 and B2. And now we can go around the arrows, the superpotential. This is a clockwise direction. We will give a plus sign. And we will go around the node, A1, this is B2. This is A2. And this is B1. Right, so I wrote down the superpotential for the first interaction term. And the second interaction term, actually I did not count how many nodes do we have. So I have two faces. Each face has four nodes, but each node is shared by four faces. So altogether, we have two nodes, two independent nodes. We can choose them to be this one and this one. And here we can write the second term, starting from A1 here, minus A1, B1, A2, and this arrow is B2. Any questions on how to construct the quiver? What I did now gives a unique way to construct a four-dimensional Lagrangian with n equal 1 supersymmetry. Okay? Any questions about this?
1 and 2 are any groups?
1 and 2 are taken to be representatives of UN groups, where N is the number of Dibrains. And now, this might be familiar as the theory, the gauge theory on the conifold.
Do they have to be the same group?
We may change the ranks, but if we want to keep conformal invariance and if we want to talk about Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, what we want to do is to take all groups to have the same rank and to take the large n limit. But it's extremely interesting to consider cases in which the ranks are different, and then we will have interesting flows. But I won't have time to discuss it today. I think it's much richer to consider the case in which ranks are different, and we don't have a good understanding yet of how to analyze those cases. Any other questions? So, given a two-dimensional tiling, a tiling of the two-dimensional plane, periodic, we are able to construct a four-dimensional Lagrangian. And so now we can think, what kind of tilings can we get? We can get hexagonal tilings like this. And let's do an example in which all tiles are the same, meaning that I take this hexagonal lattice and I'm saying that I'm just identifying periodically in such a way that the same tile is repeated.
You're saying, in general, do you need the tiling to be regular? Or?
No, but that's the simplest.
Okay.
Right? I can have, pick your favorite tiling. Think of tiling your bathroom with a design that you like. Pick your favorite tiling, and we have now rules of how to construct the Guibor gauge theory, and soon we will see how to construct the Sasaki-Einstein manifold.
So long as your bathroom is a torus.
Right. But most people do choose periodic tiling.
That's right.
Okay, any other? Okay, so... Those of you who don't know recognize this theory. This is a very familiar theory based on the rules that we have said. So let me do it. Right. So there's one group. Just tell me when to stop, when you recognize this theory. Here's an arrow which goes out. It goes out from the same, from one group to itself. Therefore, it will be an adjoint. This one will go in, but in order not to double count, I will just count the arrows which go out. We can also count how many different arrows there are. There are 6 arrows for a hexagon, and each each edge is shared by 2 faces, so there are 3 independent arrows. So we'll have 3 adjoint fields in n equal 1 supersymmetry, and we will get n equals 4, the n equals 4 gauge theory. How many nodes do we have? We have 6 nodes. Each node is shared by 3 faces, so altogether we have 2 independent nodes. And those nodes are cubic, right? Each node has a valence 3, has a cubic interaction, and we remember that the gauge, the superpotential for the n equals 4 theory looks like that. Phi 1, phi 3, phi 2. And you can convince yourself that this indeed is what we read from the gauge theory. So we learned that there are two simple tilings of the plane. The two simplest are with hexagons and with squares. Hexagons corresponds to C3. This is the Calabi-Yau that will be dual to the n equals 4 gauge theory. And squares are dual to the conifold. Okay? We can, there are other tilings of the two-dimensional plane, like triangles, but triangles we cannot allow because when we go around the face, and since we assign this alternating rule that arrows alternate, for an odd-sided face, this is not consistent. Okay, so we are going to concentrate on even-sided tiles.
In this combinatorial way, is there an easier way to encode spin-code deformations?
Deformations? That's an interesting question. We made these signs here to be plus and minus, but we could make them, for example, have a complex phase, and that will be, for example, the beta deformation. The beta deformation would be like putting a flux over an intersection point over here. Now, I haven't studied this in detail, so I cannot tell you results about this, but this is an idea. Any other questions?
Is this in general something that allows you to then add fractional brains, or this is just for this phase?
Adding fractional brains would correspond to the question that John was asking, how to change ranks. And to change ranks, I will take it in such a way that each phase here has a different quantum number, the number of brains that I put on it.
Would you give an example of that, or this is...
So think of the square lattice. And put n brains here and m brains over here. That's an example which breaks supersymmetry, breaks conformal invariance. You begin a duality cascade, and actually it's interesting to study. The gauge couplings can be related to areas of those faces, and you will have some kind of a dynamical flow of those theories. So this is the Klebanov-Strassler duality cascade. Any other questions? Now, once we have the quiver gauge theory, the superpotential, and the gauge field, the matter fields, we can apply the A maximization. Brian Vecht will talk about it next week, so I'm not going to concentrate on that. I'm just going to say that it is possible to compute those things. Using the A maximization, I can compute R charges for fundamental fields, or for basic fields, I will call them. And by this, I mean the fields which participate in the quiver. And I can also compute A, the central charge, of the conformal field theory, a quantity which is a good measure or a reasonable measure for the number of degrees of freedom in the system. Okay? So this is what I can do using the gauge theory side. Now let us see how we can get information about the Sasaki-Einstein manifold. Okay, so I'm now going to treat my tiling as a dimer configuration. So let me say some few words on dimers. And I'm going to take my tiling and look at the nodes. Let's take, for simplicity, four different nodes. And a dimer would be a line that connects two nodes. So a dimer is a line connecting two nodes. And naturally, I have some combinatorial problem here. I can ask, given four points, how many different ways can I fill lines in between the nodes, which will be giving rise to different configurations. So for four nodes, and in such a way that all nodes are ends of a line, but precisely one line. Each node will be an end of precisely one line. So I can do it like that. Here, each node is an end of precisely one line. Or I can do it like that. Okay? When I take two nodes and I match them together, this is called matching. And if I match all nodes, it is called perfect matching. So this is a perfect matching. And for our example, for given four nodes, there are two different perfect matchings.
Could you connect them like diagonally?
The rules are that neighbors are considered across links. For us, neighbors will be whenever there are edges which connect between them. So if we are choosing a square lattice, then I can only connect in this way. If I will choose a hexagonal lattice, then edges can only be the edges that I'm drawing. Okay, those are dimers. And now I want to use those dimers in order to compute information about the Calabi-Yau manifold, right? I already know what is the...
So you start with the tiling, and then you construct the dimer for a given tiling, or this is just a completely different structure?
No, that's precisely the logic, right? I'm starting with the tiling, and now I'm thinking about possible perfect matchings that I can do. Okay? And in order to compute this combinatorial problem of how many perfect matchings do I have, I will introduce a matrix which is called an adjacency matrix or the Kastelein matrix. Kastelein was a mathematical physicist active in the 60s, and he was studying statistical mechanical systems which have to do with Ising models. I'm not sure precisely what was his motivation. That will be interesting to find out. In any case, the Kastelein matrix is an adjacency matrix which tells how black nodes are related to white nodes, how they are connected to each other. So in order to understand the Kastelein matrix, let's take an example. This example again. Now let's take this figure here and replace one by one, 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 and two. And let me now figure out what is the fundamental domain. So in order to figure out what is the fundamental domain, I will take a point, pick an arbitrary point in a face, and repeat it four times. So let's take this point over here. It's repeated here, and here, and here. And it gives me a fundamental domain. If I would have color, this would be probably more visible. And now you can see that if I take this pattern, which is located over here, and if I copy the fundamental domain, I will get this periodic pattern. Okay, there are two nodes. One white, one black. And the Kastelein matrix will tell how they talk to each other. How many nodes are they connected with? So I will write the Kastelein. So in this case, the matrix becomes the generate. And it instead of matrix, it's a one by one. It's just a number. Okay, because there is one white, one black. If I had two black, two white, I would have a 2x2 matrix and so on. Right? Number of white nodes is always equal to number of black nodes, and therefore this matrix is always a square matrix. Now I will write the Kastelein matrix in such a way that I keep track of which fundamental domain I cross. Right? So let's look at this node over here. Right? It's connected to four nodes, white here, and white here, and white here. Okay? This black node is connected to this white node within the fundamental domain. To this white node, it is connected to the fundamental domain, which is Thank you very much. The fundamental domain, which is over here, this white node is connected to the fundamental domain, which is here, and this white node is over here. Okay? So in order to keep track of the direction, I will introduce a direction X. If I go in that way, and Y if I go that way, and I will write the Castellan matrix as a sum of those four contributions, one for this guy, X for jumping to the fundamental domain, which is in that direction. I jump one fundamental domain, therefore I'll give it a weight X. Y to the fundamental domain over here. And XY to this guy. Okay, because it's jumping one fundamental domain to this direction and one below, so it has a weight XY. Okay, and this is the Castellan matrix. It's a polynomial, general polynomial in X and Y. And I can always write it sum Cij, X to the power I, Y to the power J. And therefore, it describes a point or a set of points on a two-dimensional lattice, where the indices of this lattice are the exponents of X and Y. Okay, so let's try to draw the exponents. Here, for the coefficient 1, the exponent is 0, 0 for XY. So I will write a node 0, 0. This is a point on the two-dimensional lattice with the exponents 1, 0. So it will be over here. This point is with exponent 0, 1. And it's located over here. And this point is with exponents XY, 1, 1. Is this clear up to now what I did? Any questions?
Could you say again what matching and perfect matching are?
Sorry. Okay, so a matching will be taking two points which are neighboring to each other and connecting them with a line, with a dimer.
So a matching is a dimer?
Yes, is a dimer. A perfect matching is a case in which I match all points.
I see. So a dimer is just configuration of two points with a bond. A perfect matching is some configuration of all of that.
That's right.
So sorry, the construction of this Castellan matrix is independent of how you choose this fundamental domain?
Yes.
From where it starts?
Yes, it's independent. Sometimes I will get different exponents. For example, I could have chosen to give weight X an overall. I could have multiplied this equation by an overall factor, but I don't care about overall rescaling, and I don't care about shifts in the X and Y directions.
Three
degrees of freedom. Yes. And then I keep track.
How do you know to...
You're putting an adjacency matrix. But each arrow, instead of just being counted with a 1, is counted with the direction that you have to go to get to the fundamental domain at the other end of that arrow.
All right, so here...
Adjacency matrix for who?
For black nodes and white nodes. So there's only one of each in this case.
Okay, so here I remain within the fundamental domain. Here, within the same fundamental domain, here I go to the fundamental domain, which is in the X direction. Here, this link is in the fundamental domain in the Y direction, and so on. And I get this matrix.
So is it important that all these points, the all other points are black points? So can there be like white and black points? Well, not in this tile.
In this tiling, there is only one black point. Let's denote it with green.
Only one green.
Yeah. One green point and one red point. And this point is just repeated periodically.
Yeah, so if, for example, we have some other tiling and this green point was connected with another green point, for example.
Oh,
there's
no such thing.
There's no such
thing. Because of the orientation that we are choosing. Because we are using even-sided polygons, you can convince yourself that black nodes will be neighbors to white nodes, uh-huh, and vice versa.
Can you have more than two variables, like different directions, or?
Yeah. I'm sorry. There is only x and y. This is a two-dimensional plane, right? There are only they form a basis. Right, I denote the fundamental domain using two variables.
It's not so obvious for other shapes like hexagons.
Right. For hexagon, let's do for hexagons. Let's pick a point.
That's what he's really doing. He's tying the two points and unwrapping it to a point. So he's got to have a double periodicity.
I'm using a simple fundamental domain. Okay, let me do a fundamental domain here.
If you're tiling on the torus, then you could find a fundamental domain with only two. There you go.
What I did was to pick a point, an arbitrary point, and repeat it four times. And now I have a fundamental domain, and this thing here is just repeated continuously. And again, we see that for this example, there are two independent points, one white, one black. As we expect also from the superpotential of n equals 4 gauge theory, one white, one black.
Did you invent all these rules to describe results you already knew and then use them to predict new ones?
This work, the work of the Kastelein matrix, obviously goes back to Kastelein. I'm not sure if Kastelein introduced the notion of directions of periodic of being on the torus, these x and y weights. This we learned from a work by Richard Kenyon. He's a mathematician from British Columbia. Kenyon. Dimers also appeared in the work of Vafa. There is a paper by Reshetikin, Okunkov, and Vafa. This was called Calabi-Yau crystals. Dimers appeared there, but the connection to this work is still a problem. It's something that few people have asked me, and I still don't know how to connect them.
Just to rephrase John's question, eventually you're going to tell us that this gauge theory with this prescription has a dual, which is a specific Sasaki-Einstein.
Yes, very
specific. And why should we believe that?
Ah, that's a good question. I don't have a proof. I can only show examples. In all examples that I did, it worked very well.
But in all examples, the gauge theory was already known or could already be calculated a different way?
No, not really. I mean, for example, the LPQR, it was not known before.
Which?
The certain Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, which are deformations of the YPQ manifold. Do you know the YPQ? Mm-hmm. So the LPQR is slight generalization of them.
LPQR,
yeah. And they pass tests of computing. I guess, you know, one test is to compute R charges and the central charge using the gauge theory, using a maximization. And on the side, once you know what is the Calabi-Yau manifold, you can do the Z minimization, compute volumes. without knowledge of the metric, so you don't have to know the metric. So I can compare it to Z minimization. And I find agreement. So, I don't know, it's, I think it should have a proof. I don't know the proof for that. Yeah, we are only dealing with toric Calabi-Yau manifolds, and the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds will also be called toric. Any other?
For the Castellan matrix, can you get minus sum?
Right. So for this example, since this was a one-by-one matrix, signs were not crucial. But there is another rule that we need to introduce. And this is for the minus signs. So going around the face, we want to have the number of minus signs number of minus signs to be odd for the order is 0 mod 4 and even if the order is 2 mod 4. By this, what I mean is that if we are dealing with hexagons, the order is just the number of edges for the face. It's 6, it is equal to 2 mod 4, and I would it's okay to put signs such that the number of signs will be even. Okay, so I can, for example, choose all of them. I can choose 0 signs in such a configuration. But if I'm dealing with squares, like here, I would have to at least one edge to get it to be minus sign. And
number of signs in what? I mean, you did
these. Going around the face.
Like all terms have a plus sign.
Going around the face. Okay, so this will not satisfy this rule. But if I will choose this thing here, then I will satisfy the rule.
So what's the meaning of the signs? So you have this polynomial, and what is the meaning of plus and minus?
What's the meaning of the polynomial?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so let's try to see the meaning of the polynomial. So the polynomial gave us a set of points on a two-dimensional lattice. Some of you may identify this as the toric diagram for the conic fold. And this is going to be general. Starting from a tiling configuration, we can compute the adjacency matrix, we can compute the Castellan matrix, and its determinant will always give the toric diagram for the corresponding Calabi-Yau manifold. So that's the connection with the Calabi-Yau manifold. So determinant of K let's write it here. The determinant of the Castellan matrix will give the toric diagram for the Calabi-Yau manifold.
What labels the rows and columns of Castellan matrix?
So rows will be white and columns will be black, or vice versa.
So the size is the number of black points within the fundamental domain.
Yes, which is always equal to the number of white points.
And once you computed the determinant, how do you read off the toric diagram?
By taking the the determinant will always have this form with certain coefficients, and for each monomial, I place a point. whenever coefficient is non-zero. Okay, so let's do another example for C3 mod Z3.
One looks at the exponents of the x and y, the power of x and y, to place the where to put the bound.
So again, this returning to my question about the sign. So you to each monomial you put a point. So you put a sign with it.
We don't have a good interpretation for the sign. Most of the time, what we do is to take the absolute value of CIG.
But the signs only really matter in a matrix, right?
In a matrix, right? When taking determinants,
I don't see how they change.
That's why I did not introduce them for the one by one case, and they don't really matter. And CIJ will absolute value will have a significance.
Just a notation. Mm-hmm. Which one is the Castellani matrix? Because K is a polynomial. So you say determinant of K.
For one by one matrix, the determinant is the same as. So let's. So since there is a potential confusion, let's do a case with the 3x3 matrix. And I will do that in a slightly different way, which plays with perfect matchings. Let's now take a situation which is the same figure as I drew over there with hexagons. And now I'm going to make the periodicity in the following way. I call this phase 1. This phase I will call 2, and I will repeat it 3 times. And this phase I will call 3, and repeat it 3 times. Okay, and you should imagine some continuous configuration, which the phase here is 3, the phase here is 1, the phase here again is 1, and so on. Okay? You see the periodic pattern. Anybody has a guess what kind of gauge theory is this? 3 groups. Okay, there are 3 groups, and there are, let's denote arrows with green. There are 3 arrows from 1 going to 2. 1 going to 2 3 times. There are 3 arrows going from 2 to 3. So it's like that. And there are 3 arrows going from 3 to 1. Okay, altogether we have 9 fields. Why 9 fields? Because we have 3 hexagons. The number of edges of 3 hexagons is 18. But each edge is shared by 2 faces. So we have 9 edges, which are those 9 fields that I drew over here. How many superpotential terms? 3 hexagons have 6 nodes each, 6 nodes each, so altogether 18 nodes, but each node is shared by 3. So I have 6 independent nodes. So the superpotential terms should be a sum of 6 terms. And since the intersections are always cubic, those terms will be cubic. And for those of you who recognize this, gauge theory is going to be the theory for C3 mod Z3. And a convenient way will be to write it in terms of an epsilon symbol, AI, BJ, CK, where these are AI, BJ, CK. And IJK run over 1, 2, 3.
So you have the same gauge group that each node, un?
Yeah, right. Okay. And we learned something along the way that if we increase the number...
Sorry, in general, I mean, are you able to put in fractional brains, make the gauge group a little different?
Provided that anomaly cancellations are satisfied. For C3 mod E3, I cannot, but in general, yes.
But then that must change all these rules.
Yeah, this is related to what John was asking. Okay, well, so...
I don't want to derail him.
It is very interesting. It breaks conformal invariance in general. You are then bound to do all of these duality cascades, and there is a flow. Beta functions are non-zero. It's extremely interesting. Yeah, generically it does, right? Because it varies. The beta functions depend on the ranks, and... if you start with zero, then generically it will be non-zero.
Is the gauge group actually un cubed, or are you dividing out by the u1s?
I prefer not to touch the u1, so it will be un cubed. But if you are dealing with the cyborg duality, it's the usual problems that you have. You are thinking of it as an sun. Sometimes you can associate the u1s with global symmetries, and that's...
How about what if the u1?
The overall U1?
No, I mean, well, the three U1s. I'm always confused about what happens.
Okay, so some of them are anomalous. And you can take some... some of them are anomalous.
There's a statement in my paper with quantum anomalies.
Okay, what is it?
The correct gauge group is U...
S of U of all of them. Like this, S.
No, the U one part is also used, but diagonal one is trivial. Diagonal U one is trivial.
Okay.
And the remaining gauge symmetry is actually U, the product of SUN. And you can make a different theory by gauging the global symmetries and get a product.
Wait. So we have a product of SUNs, and then how many U1s? Forgetting about discrete.
Oh, this depends on the details of the toric diagram. Number of...
And that's a gauge theory, albeit free, and almost decoupled.
Yeah.
You said number of nodes minus one?
Mm-hmm.
Number of nodes minus one?
Yeah.
There are, actually this is...
that's something to talk about later, because I think that that doesn't quite match with the supergravity
rule. No, it matches very nicely.
Okay. I'd like to see that.
Okay, yeah, and if I won't have time to talk about it, Sergio will talk about it in detail on Monday. Okay? And it's quite... I can just... tell you that if a toric diagram has n external points, then there are baryonic symmetries U1 symmetries.
Global symmetries.
N minus 3 of them.
But the point is that those N minus 3 can be seen as a combination of the U1, of the single U1 you are thinking about at the gate.
Okay, so I see. Yeah. Let's discuss that later, because it will be a distraction from the main discussion. But it has been studied, and we can have lots of discussions about that. Okay. We have the tiling for C3 mod Z3. We want to see an example of a Castellane matrix, which is 3x3 instead of 1x1. And again, what we will do is to pick the fundamental domain. And let's do it over here. And there is the gauge group number 2 will be here. is gauge group number two. I will put the point here, and now I connect those points. I did a mistake. This line should not go inside. Because of my drawing skills, this line should be outside. If you'll do it properly.
You pick the wrong point.
Oh, I picked the wrong point. Definitely. Okay, I see. So it's not. Okay. So let's try it again. It's not good to pick the wrong point. The right point is here. And it should be like that. I don't know if it's better now. Those lines should be parallel. yeah. I'm sorry. I'm not. The important point is that we have 6 points inside, 3 white, 3 black. Okay? And we can still keep track of the fundamental domains, but now I will do that not by writing explicitly the Castellane matrix. We already have the rules of how to write it down, but I will now count perfect matchings. So in order to do that, I will write every field once, and I will write it in this symbol. Right, this is the symbol that we are going to take. It takes every field precisely once, right? The fields which go from 1 to 2 are taken once. Fields which go from 3 to 1 are taken once. And the fields which go from 2 to 3. This, this, and this. Okay, 9 fields altogether. And now I'm going to do perfect matchings. And perfect matchings means that I need to take those 6 points and to connect them by 3 dimers. So here's an example. Here's one example to connect 3 points with 6 points by 3 dimers. Okay? But I can do it in a different way. Like that. Right? And this is a perfect matching, right? Because every point is connected, is an end of precisely one line. And I have, this is not so visible, so maybe I'll change the color to red. Okay. And I will. I have a few other options to do that. For example, I can take those 3 lines. That's another perfect matching, remembering that the end of the line over here is just this point. Okay, by periodicity. I'm just looking at the covering space, and I see that this line here is just ending over here, right? And now I have 3 other options. I can take this styling, this dimer here, and the note. This is another perfect matching, and I have rotations of it. So let me draw the last. And do it. There will be one which will look like that, and one which will look like that. Those are the 6 different perfect matchings that I can use in order to cover those 3 points. Okay? So you can think of it as a Hilbert space. I mean, if you are thinking in terms of a statistical mechanical problem, you can consider this as a Hilbert space. For each configuration, you can assign some energy, and then you can do you can write down a partition function based on the Hamiltonian, which is giving weights. I mean, we can now think of how to put weights on such a system.
So this relation to the statistical mechanical system, so does it go farther than just graphically you're using this as some way to get finally to this
one? Okay, so last time I mentioned the work of Muto. Muto was doing Ising model on a triangular lattice. And this triangular lattice appears as the dual to this graph. If I replace faces by nodes and nodes by faces, I get the triangular lattice. And Muto was writing down an Ising model, two-dimensional Ising model, and such that he defined the energies such that the ground states were those perfect matchings. Now, that's one way, and maybe there are other ways. I'm not familiar with that so much.
So, but once we know that, then what information?
So since we're approaching that from point of view of either quiver gauge theory or Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, always we need to ask the question: what does it teach us about the manifold? What does it teach us about the quiver gauge theory or the ADS-CFT correspondence? So far, I'm not sure, but it may be. But I can tell you that those coefficients here, Cij, are counting the number of linear sigma model fields that you need in order to construct the Calabi-Yau manifold as a Kähler quotient.
But what does it have to do with perfect matchings?
Ah, good. So let's try to continue. Let's now assign a weight for each of one of these six objects. And assign it in such a way that if I remain within the fundamental domain, I will gain each dimer will carry the corresponding weight. So this dimer is within the fundamental domain. I will give it the weight 0, 0. This dimer is also within the fundamental domain. I will give weight 0, 0. And I will assign the total weight as the sum of all weights. So the weights of this particular configuration is 0, 0. Right? The dimers do not go out of the fundamental domain.
The 0, 0 is obtained in the sum?
Sorry?
The 0, 0 for the whole diagram?
Yeah, the whole is the sum, yeah. Over here again, the overall weight of the diagram is 0, 0. Over here, it's also 0, 0, even though it's not that simple. But we can see that this object, you can go. So let's define directions. Roughly like that. And what we are seeing is that, let me see. If this one goes, plus one. Right. So this one, let's say that this one goes 1, 0. This is 0, 1. And this is -1, -1. Summing all of them together will give a weight 0. Okay. On the other hand, the weight, the total weight of this diagram will be 0, 1. The total weight of this diagram will be 1, 0. n of this diagram will be minus 1, right? Because there are two dimers with zero weight and one dimer with weight minus 1. Okay? And again, I'm reminding that those weights are taking track of which fundamental domain did I go to. Okay, so I choose a convention, and I chose a convention that going in this direction up would correspond to 0, 1, or to the to going in a y direction, and going in this direction is 1, 0. Okay?
Let's have a diagram where two legs are going outward and one in the hexagon is connected.
Two legs going outward?
So two legs are going outward and one in the hexagon is connected.
This will be, the only diagram will be this one.
Those have three legs going out of the hexagon. So suppose you have only two legs going out of the
hexagon. And this one? Ah, but then it's not a perfect matching.
Well, which one vertex?
Because this vertex is already this vertex.
Oh.
Because of the periodicity, right? So, but what you're asking is a good question, right? We have a combinatorial problem over here, and we want to count efficiently how to do that. And the Kastelein matrix precisely does this thing for you, right? So I first introduced the Kastelein matrix, but I could have introduced this problem as a combinatorial problem that the Kastelein matrix solves very neatly. It counts how many configurations you have of any given weight. And the number of such configurations is the absolute value of those numbers Cij. Okay? So we can now draw the toric diagram. The point 0, 0 has multiplicity 3. The point 1, 0 has multiplicity 1. Point 0, 1 has another multiplicity 1. And point minus 1 has, again, multiplicity 1. And we have constructed the toric diagram for C3 mod Z3. Okay? And now I presented the procedure of how to start with the tiling and get the corresponding Calabi-Yau manifold. We got the corresponding Calabi-Yau manifold as in the form of a toric diagram. So now we need to know how to take this toric data that we get and to translate it to things that we understand possibly better. For example, we want to know what are volumes of subcycles in the Sasaki-Einstein manifold.
I have a question.
Yes.
If I look at the Kastelein matrix, can't I have two different matrices which will give me the same determinant, and so two different
yeah, but
series which will have the same Calabi-Yau manifold?
You can have such a thing, and this is something which is known under the name Seiberg duality. And sometimes, actually, you can have different Kastelein matrices with different dimensions, but they have the same determinant. And that would just correspond to different numbers of terms in the superpotential. Right? But nevertheless, they will be equivalent.
Not only the superpotential, I mean, all the tiling could be very different.
Yes, right. So that's a good question. Let's try to analyze this. What does it mean to do Seiberg duality in terms of the tilings? Any questions before I proceed?
So, with this, trying to get a sense for component dimensions of the theory.
Yes.
Perhaps they also included in this combinatorics. The naive guess is that the internal points might correspond to the breaks with infinity form.
Yeah.
Just to test it. What would be the diagram to draw for for the second example, for honeycomb with the same gauge groups.
The diagram, the toric diagram, it will be three points. If you go to go to the lectures that Vafa would give, let's say 2 years ago, then he will use this C3 as an example for describing toric geometry. You can take the dual graph, which would look like this. Okay, and each line here represents a copy of C.
Now, do I understand each vertex is giving a term in the superposition?
Each vertex here? No. Each.
So the
external points correspond to certain types of two cycles, which. In the Calabi-Yau, they start as Calabi-Yau, as two cycles in the Calabi-Yau, and they become three cycles in the Sasaki-Einstein geometry. So each external point here is can be thought of as an element in the basis of three cycles. And but actually we need to subtract three. So for C3. There are no three cycles. We know that S5 has no three cycles. So the number of external points, n minus 3, is you can take it to be the number of independent, homologically non-trivial three cycles in the Sasaki-Einstein geometry. And the internal points, if we have here, we have one internal point. This internal point corresponds to a four cycle in the Calabi-Yau manifold, a compact four cycle in Calabi-Yau manifold. For the case of C3 mod Z3, it's a P2. And there are corresponding properties that we can assign to it.
In relation to
the superposition, there's no direct relation that I can think of.
C3 mod Z3 is
a cone on a Lens space, not S5, right? S5 mod Z3, yes. So this is the toric diagram for C3 mod Z3. This is the toric diagram for C3. Or this one. Yeah, so I don't know. You were asking me how to associate points on the toric diagram with superpotential terms. I am not sure. I don't know if the others have thought about that. Probably, yeah. Maybe there is.
So given a toric diagram, could you restore the Tyler?
So here. A good question. So that's a very natural thing to do. We saw how to start with the tiling and to reproduce the toric diagram. But what about the inverse process? And there is a procedure for doing that. We're actually going to put out a paper soon of how to do that. David Veig did a lot of work of how to do that. And the answer is yes. There is a procedure to do that. It just takes time to how to describe that. We just need to introduce some more formalism, but in principle, it's done. It's doable. So let's now draw some kind of flow chart, just to tell us what's the bigger picture. And okay. So first of all, we start with the tiling. Using the tiling, we can get the periodic weaver. And the periodic weaver, I talked about it on Monday, so for those of you who haven't been here on Monday, the periodic weaver is just taking the tiling and taking its dual, right? Replacing faces by nodes and edges by arrows. So it's the dual graph to it. Okay? So we can try to draw the periodic quiver for this guy, and I may have some figures to show. So that's the periodic quiver. And then we can, using the tiling, we can compute the quiver itself, either from here or from here. We saw the rules. And when we say quiver here, we get it including the superpotential, including the interaction term. So we get the full n equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theory. Then we can think of this tiling problem as a dimer problem and get the toric diagram. Using the Castelli matrix. Its determinant gives us the curve that describes the toric diagram. We can also get the coefficients, and that's the number of perfect matchings. And now we can introduce this as a characteristic of the Calabi-Yau manifold, of the orbifold. For those of you who've been here on Monday, I mentioned that for orbifolds, it's possible to have new numbers which characterize the singularity. Those numbers are those Cij, and they are associated with each point in the toric diagram. Let's assume that we take the toric diagram for C3, and if we want to draw a toric diagram for an orbifold, C3, modeled out by Zn cross Zm, this will just correspond to a refinement of the lattice by m points over here and n points over here. So the typical toric diagram would look like an m plus 1 by n plus 1 triangle. Each point will come with multiplicities. Those multiplicities are characteristics of this Calabi-Yau manifold. It's beyond what is typically denoted. Typically, when people draw a toric diagram, they just draw the points. But now we have a new characterization in terms of the multiplicities. So I can give you a few examples.
Those numbers are invariant under cyberdweller.
For the case of that's why I mentioned it for the case of orbifolds. For the case of orbifolds, there's only one such thing, I haven't seen that they do not. Well, I'm not a mathematician, so I cannot tell you whether they do or not. But I think this is something which is very important to look at. Let me just draw the numbers for Z3 mod Z3. And those are unique. Okay? I can also write down Castelli matrices for generic orbifolds. And If the orbifold for C3 will be given by, if the Castelli matrix will be given by the following polynomial, 1 plus x plus y, this is the curve that you would get from one hexagon repeated continuously. Then a Castelli matrix for Zn cross Zm, Fnm of x and y, will take the following form. Product I goes from 0 to n minus 1. Product j goes from 0 to n minus 1. F of lambda I is c to the 1 over n. Lambda I is e to the over m, and omega to the power j w, well, it's not good, lambda prime to the power j w to the power 1 over n. Well, I changed notations, so let's call this x, let's call this y. Okay, and lambda I and lambda prime, lambda to the power n m is equal to 1, and lambda prime to the power n is equal to 1. So I get formulas which generate those numbers in an efficient way. Okay, so this is a formula that takes time in order to show, but roughly what it means is that you take the polynomial and you act with the generator of the orbifold group. For each, there is a factor for each orbifold generator, and you get a polynomial. The polynomial generically takes this form, sum Cij x to the power I y to the power j, and those Cij are the multiplicities that I was talking about. Okay. I guess what I did now was a bit too fast. Any questions for...
So you are getting some kind of refined Turing diagram, so usually you wouldn't put any multiplicities, right?
That's right, yeah.
So these multiplicities again, how you get them? So what geometric data do they correspond to?
I asked a few mathematicians. I asked David Morrison. He doesn't give a satisfactory answer. I asked, and it's a pity that he's not here. I mean, he could have told you by himself what he thinks about those. I asked people who do McKay correspondence, derived categories. Still, I didn't get a satisfactory answer. That's why I think they are interesting. They give you information. Mm-hmm. On the manifolds.
So
I asked Sheldon Katz.
Some invariant information?
Not necessarily invariant. Yeah. The comment of Chris was that under Seiberg duality, those numbers are changing. But for orbifolds, there are no Seiberg dualities that keep the same rank, and therefore those numbers are unique. So for orbifolds, we can claim that those numbers are unique. Mm-hmm. But only for orbifolds. But in general, those are beautiful numbers. I prepared the slides which will show that. Let me do this. And the in principle, there are some formulas that you can write down, which give you the multiplicities quite nicely. This is a nice combinatorial result. Is this open? said ready. Let me see. I don't know what to do. Yeah, so in principle, you can compute those numbers. The reason I'm giving a lot of attention to those is that I think that they are important. And to summarize, those numbers are counting the number of perfect matchings. And here they are for small examples. We have a generating function which computes that basically any value that you want. Here are other numbers. It's quite easy to compute those numbers. Okay. What next? Let me. Make a summary of what we went over today. Well, we can leave. No, we don't want to leave it. yeah. So what do we need to see more? So we have the quiver gauge theories. Using the quiver gauge theories, we can compute our charges and the A maximization. This we haven't seen, right? And actually, it turns out that the R charges get a nice interpretation in terms of the dimers. Maybe Brian will talk about it. the Z minimization. How can we use the toric data? What I did was just to show you the toric data, but I didn't tell you how to use the toric data in order to learn about the quantities of the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. So this is done using the Z minimization. So hopefully, we will hear about that as well. I mentioned a little bit about the Ising model and about how to compute those multiplicities.
So actually, I didn't understand that. So those multiplicities can be computed in some statistical model, you said? That
yes.
Lives where? So I didn't understand that.
Oh, what is the model? Basically, you take the periodic quiver. Okay, and on the periodic quiver, the nodes are now the gauge groups instead of the faces. And on each node, you put a spin, plus minus one, and you define the Hamiltonian to be a sum over all the edges with products of two sigmas, one sigma from each node. Right, so it's
so for all these cases, the statistical model is done with the Ising model. All the changes is going to be the lattice component.
The change would be the lattice, yes. Okay. That's right. The Ising model is the same. The change will be the lattice. And the problem is to compute the number of ground states. And the number of ground states reproduces the total number of multiplicities.
The total number.
Yeah, but Mutu also showed how to get them individually. You just need to do anisotropic Ising model to put different weights. But he showed how to do that. I don't have time to show it now. But that's an interesting point. I mean, this Ising model, that's an interesting research direction. Okay, we did not discuss the properties of the quiver gauge theories, and I hope that Sergio will do that. Chris has worked on a totally different way of how to construct the quiver gauge theories, starting from the toric diagrams, which is related to your question, taking a toric diagram how to do the computation of the quiver, and he's going to talk about exceptional collections and how you can use them in order to compute the quivers. Another interesting direction is to treat the problem with different ranks, which is probably extremely interesting, but we haven't touched it today. And what else? I think more or less I'm done with this. Let me just see. What we did not discuss is, actually I did not show what is a cyborg duality in terms of the quivers. That's related to your question. So it's a very simple action on the tiling. I won't do it now. We can discuss that after that if you want. But this brings about a very interesting question, which is again related to what you were asking. What, given a geometry, how many different gauge theories can you have which will give the same geometry? Now, typically the number for that is infinite if you are allowing for the ranks of the gauge groups to be different. But you can put a restriction by saying that the number, that the ranks of the gauge group will all be the same. And then you get a finite number. And this again is a number which characterizes the geometry. If we are dealing with Delpezzo 3, then there are four different phases. If we are dealing with Delpezzo 2, there are two of them. And if we are dealing with YPQ manifolds, then the number of such phases grows as 3 to the power p. So it's a very different number in each case, and those are numbers that we can compute. And again, those are interesting numbers for the geometry.
Can you relate placement of the fractional grains to some transition between different tilings?
Placement of fractional brains to transitions of tilings.
Because the duality cascade moves from one theory to the cyclic dual continuously, so two tilings are a cyclic dual, I would expect something.
Yeah, if you so in order to do that, I need to introduce some interpretation in terms of brains, which I didn't do today. That's another point that we can discuss, and then you can argue that the transition is continuous. I did not want to discuss it today, but this is quite interesting. Okay, that's what I... Yeah, thank you.